some of the strongest organizations is the Philippine Women's Club.
Oh, where's that based?
Here in LA, Philippine Women's Club, San Pagita Women's Club, the physician school. The presidents are women. The women are pretty strong in the community. And I would say that some of the men just stay aside, maybe things would be a little better. Because there's a little more to the saying of they're compassionate. They're strong leaders. They practice it and they do it and in their profession. A lot of my doctors, my dentist is a woman, my physician is a woman. I have gone to some of the male doctors too, but basically it's there.
Right. Yeah. When did you meet your wife?
In the Bunker Hill dance hall. Right there. And that's back in the, 56? Oh, yes, 56. Yeah, because I went into the army in 57. 56, 57, 58. So 56, the early part of 55, I guess. The latter part of 55, 56. And we met over through a Philippine, Miss Philippines dance. Her sister was running as one of the candidates. Because the dance, that's how we met, and that's why I was saying, all of the guys hang around over there, and that's where we meet them. And then the sister, friend of mine, was very interested in this younger sister, and so we got introduced there in the dance floor, and then from there we visited, and then I went into the army, so just through correspondence and visiting, then we sort of stayed together. But although before that there were a lot of other young girls around that we ran around with. And, being honest, the mother was one of the taxi dancers. My father-in-law married a Chicana who hanged around in the taxi dance halls in the 30s. And a lot of the Filipino old-timers married a lot of the taxi dance halls. Now, the taxi dance halls, there are two kinds, I guess, two or three different kinds of women that goes there. One by necessity, one is for obviously sexual exploitation, and others is just, hey, I got to earn a living. My understanding is my mother-in-law and her sister, that this was the depression. They got to earn a living. And so the taxi dancer was convenient. And then I think she was only 14, 15. So my father was probably in his 20s and decided, hey, this is not the place for you, and they got married. And they have several children. But that was part of that, and that's not the only one. A lot of people we know.
And your wife's mother was Chicana.
Chicana Indian, yeah. Mexican Indian.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Who just moved here, I think, from Albuquerque, New Mexico or something.
And then how many children do you have?
And by the way, they have, because the anti-miscegenation law, they did not get married in L.A. It was against the law. They married in Tijuana.
Ah, did many people go to Tijuana, or did they just go to the state?
Yeah, Tijuana, Mexico, or New Mexico, or Arizona. I think it was allowable. Idaho. Certain places were not. Yeah, certain places that was allowed. But they went to, as I understand, they went to Tijuana. And interestingly enough, my wife and the family never knew that. It was only the last few years of my dad, father-in-law, who finally, when we started asking questions, the parents said, "Well, by the way, how did you meet my? What was your?" They never shared some of that unless you asked. And you never asked. I didn't know you were interested, that kind. But they never talked about some of that. And there were a lot of struggles and said stories of the old timers, the early pioneers, because they faced so much. Racism, anti-miscegenation law, and no social and political. They cannot own property. They cannot marry whites. Anti-miscegenation. You cannot live in certain area. They cannot vote. They were nationals. That's what the old timers face, and so the second generation begin to feel that. And interestingly enough, one of the key things from the old timers is they would not put a lot of emphasis on education. Well, education in the Philippines is education, a big one. and always you got to move up through education. Here it was the opposite. He said, forget it, you're not going to move up here. Just don't bother to go to college or go to school. And a great deal of the second generation did not go to school. They finished high school, let's say, go to work. Some of them, again, the discouragement by the parents or not enough support, education is not for us. It might be related to the to whatever the messages the Filipino received in terms of we're not going to be here, we're here as a sojourner, we came here to make money, we're going to go back, you know, that's kind of things. And you will not advance. Many of the old-timers, and the pensionados and those students who came as students or stayed never got any job, decent job, that they were promised, or at least through their education. They may have BAs, masters, or even PhDs, but they could not really get any kind of decent job in the 40s and the 50s. So they discouraged that. And so some of the second generation, like us, some of them went into the army, and then out of the army, GI Bill. Many of them went through that.
Was that, you had already gone to college before the army?
Yeah.
I was lucky. On the GI Bill?
I know, I didn't need it. Already done.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I could use it if I wanted to. I used some of my money to buy a house, you know, but. So, those are some of the byproducts of this, of what was happening, the condition.
Where did you buy your house when you came back out of the army?
When I finally bought a house, it's through a Filipino real estate who knew the place that I should buy a house without any problem.
What year was this?
This goes back to the middle 60s maybe, or late 60s.
So
yeah, late
still,
60s.
When you say there wasn't any problem, what do you mean?
In buying property for Filipinos in that area.
So
he knew where it's safe to buy or get it, and he can get it. You know, he was really a good real estate person who did everything that we should be able to get it without any problem. Financially, as well as not run into racism or other kind of attacks.
So
it ended up towards Gardena. Yeah, towards Gardena, edge of Gardena, north Gardena side.
So in the real estate, I mean, yours. So there were obviously still problems. In the late 60s, you're saying to know the right place to buy the house. And what were those problems, and where did that exist?
I don't know the specific places, but I could guess. But then I think if I said at that point in time I want to buy a house in Palos Verdes, I probably would have not. They said, you probably would say, forget it, don't go that direction. You know?
Well, that was against the law at that point. So what were the ways that people, kept others out? It was subtle, very subtle. So what I heard would be
that they would contact other real estate people to say, well, is this a place that we should be selling this property to these people? And they would ask the question, what is their ethnicity, nationality, and things like that. And say, well, if they already know, you know, there's a respect for one another, as I understand. And so they would say, hey, don't go there. Sell them. Show them these other places rather than this place, even if they say they're like that. I think you will, the subtlety of it is this, I think you will feel more comfortable in this particular place rather than in that area. And then you get the hint already that, no, you're not welcome there. And so we say, okay, that's fine, you know. And at that point, some of us, although there was demonstration, fair housing law, etc., didn't really come out to, as individual, to completely oppose it. Because, we were not connected to the fair housing people or groups or lawyers or anything. So that as individual, we just accepted it. I just accepted
with
this real estate.
I don't want to live somewhere where my neighbors don't want to talk to me. I mean, would that be part of the feeling?
Yeah.
Like, I want to live somewhere where I'm going to be
feel comfortable, and there are people there. I know some of the people, they're Filipinos over there. That's how we would say it. Interestingly enough, we moved to a place where we should, there was integration. That was integration. The concept of integration. Hey, I like to be in that neighborhood because there's a lot of other people. A few years later, everybody left.
Why?
Call it what you want.
Did you stay?
We stayed. They're still there. Now it's all black. And when we went there, man, they says, oh, this is a nice neighborhood. We have everybody here. But it didn't, 5-6 years later down the road, everybody left. We bought it from a white person. The other property we bought, twice we moved, same thing. You know, and this is interesting, you know. And we used to brag about, well, I live in an integrated neighborhood, you know, this is in the 60s, 70s, right? Whew, lo and behold, the next thing we know is everybody's selling, including the Filipinos. And so, then again, the comment is, hey, it's getting to be integrated here. We're moving out. And I said, good luck. So we stayed. We stayed. And some of the people did not move too far either. It's only about a quarter of a mile, you know. But then it's a different neighborhood altogether. So even at this point, you know, at this point in time, you know, I said, you see it. You know, so I said, oh, okay, but what are you going to do? And you know, it's people have the right to move. And some of our Japanese friends who were over there, they said, why don't you guys go with us over there? There's a place, nice place. And I said, oh, really? I says, hey, you're just chasing the rainbow. Yeah, so that's part of the experience. So my children grew up in a fairly integrated neighborhood that changes quickly too.
Yes.
Yeah, and school is the same thing.
You had spoken about the fair housing movement. When and what was that, and how were you involved?
The fair housing movement, I guess that would be, say, 70s, when we got involved in it. So one of my friends who was involved with the local fair housing, and by supporting some of their philosophies, or going to some of the meetings, and then speaking in terms of, say, our organization, we were forming this Asian coalition, and we would then take on the part of the advocates for better housing, fair housing, integration, and things like that, and membership, because I haven't paid my
current
dues. I would say that I have to say yes in a sense, because a great deal of the activities then moved to other areas. I remember some of the fair housing activities going in towards Van Nuys, San Fernando area, and they're still existing, some of those fair housing group conferences. They would give an update. You know, there were progress, you know, more people participating in terms of advocacy and fighting for the rights of the people to live where they want to live, kind of a thing. So in that sense, I would say yes. Yeah. Whether it's massive, I don't know, in terms of massive change. I feel at this point, as I look around, see how the community has grown, has shifted, that there is definitely more need for integrated neighborhood communities throughout. I'm not talking about Central LA. I'm talking about out.
What sort of effects happen in that sort of in that situation?
The disintegration. That is integration, yeah. And I think it affected the composition of the people, of the quality of life. And where I think I feel that when you move out of the community, there's going to be a new people coming in, and the way things are going to shift, the way the resources are going to shift. The value system is going to shift. There's going to be a lot of conflicts and not adjusting. There's going to be the isolation of others. You leave things either worse or it's going to get worse because you take away the quote unquote the good things that are already existing, and so the people who comes in has to undo or redo things to make it the way they want. And if people leave it, like I think a lot of people left LA and made it, I think. If people stayed together strong, it would have been a stronger community. But it was left without a lot of resources, a lot of the values that were good in there. That's how I see the shifting. And so if we, I would say that resources, the good things, they were taken away. Whether it's the school, through the integration or disintegration, the people take the good stuff, and it was left, so that there's no immediate relief to fill the gap. Then you got to redo it again. And I see it in the school, the neighborhood, and my kids went to all the public schools, from kindergarten to high school. And I felt their frustration. And in the community, and the community people, there's more isolation, I think. I don't think there's really forces that as the newcomers, new immigrants come to Central LA, and LA, there was really no systematic coming together of people. Do your thing, be there, and say, I have my own group, or don't bother me, I got my own group. There's a lot of isolation.
Oh, so each group, like the Koreans who come in, okay, they stay with the Koreans in a certain area. I mean, is that kind of what you mean?
Mm-hmm.
The Hispanic and
they're all separate. We may be living in the same neighborhood, but there's really no communication.
Because each one, you see, the key then is to have the communication between groups.
There has to be some kind of a. We lost that, I think, from the 70s on. We lost it.
But it was there.
It was there. There was a fair housing. It was coming together. Community forums.
So it would be around people, certain issues.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think from the late 70s to the 80s we just lost the whole thing. Everybody. I would say the poor leadership of the institution, government, United Way, name it, fair housing people, the immigration people, law enforcement, a lot of law enforcement. There's a lot of, to me, a lot of reaction. It was overwhelming. I would say that. There's so much change, there's so much overwhelming, so much need to do this. Probably Bradley was doing a lot of other things. The other parts of human relationship was not happening, or was beginning to lose. The big LA extravaganza of coming together, big fiesta, big activity, and street fairs.
Uh-huh.
You ever hear of those? In earlier times, the street fairs were great.
Oh, well, like Sunset Junction is one.
Yeah. Later on, that kind of got disintegrated. Then the gangs get in there, and other things, negative things come in. So that everybody just crunched. Hey, man, let's do my own thing here. I think we got caught with that. Mm-hmm. Everybody left. There's no leadership. So I'd say the poor leadership. Which is part of the charge of the riots. The poor leadership of those who were supposed to handle it. No prevention, education that went with it before and during. And I think that's still what's happening.
You don't see a shift at all yet?
No, I don't think it is. It's really done. Got a big things to worry about.
Do you think that there is a need to for a sort of Philippine town, like Chinatown, like, you know, there's...
That's the big elusive dream.
Yeah, I want to know more about that.
I got a lot of possibilities for it, and it doesn't mean that they're all united, but there's some kind of a semblance of a territorial community identified as, say, Philippine town again, or Manila town, the semblance of the community. I don't think there's nothing wrong with that if they could put it together. This community has been identified, I think, poor leadership, lack of resources, and real education to do it. It's not there. And I don't know what it takes, but probably a combination of real community organizing. We don't really have some organizers.
Is this area, sort of Beverly Temple,
it's always
Alvarado, this whole radius here, is this known as Philippine Town?
It's always been, yeah, within this neighborhood here, Union, that direction, Temple, Alvarado, Beverly. It's always been after the 50s, I would say. 60s. It's all identified because most of the movement from Bunker Hill to, you know, Bunker Hill Towers westward. So it's the congregation came here. Resources, stores, businesses, professional groups, offices, churches, besides the residential, are here. So the central LA is still the most in terms of population, and what I just said, the structures are there. But the inconsistency and some of the negative crab mentality values that some of the leadership has taken created more distortion, confusion, etc., infighting, suing one another, some of the leadership.
Do you think it's important to have that identity, a Filipino's identity connected with a geographical area in the city?
Yeah, given the area, it's plus, to me it's a plus, plus in the sense that given the what do you call it, the communities need to identify with a particular area, I think it's important. And there's a history of it anyway to go with it. So it's not something new. And if you can get the right connection of people, businesses. Like later of it, I think the poor leadership, they still don't have a chamber of commerce as such. There may be in name, but it's not really that strong. There's really no real political clout power coming from that base, and that should be part of it. So I would be plus for it, as long as you have the right mix and support for one another, and starting with the businesses, business community, and the social structures that are there. Now, in the various enclaves, various areas like, say, Cerritos or San Fernando or Eagle Rock, that seems to be developing. And there is an identification of certain areas where they know that's a Filipino businesses, control, activities. Cerritos is one. Carson, pretty strong Carson. Now they're coming out with two city council people in there.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
So something that really shows that there is that network. And maybe it's more easier because it's a smaller town of, 100,000 people. And they got about 20,000 Filipinos.
What do you think the greatest challenges that are facing the Filipino-American community right now? What are the greatest challenges?
I think one is the political and the business, the entrepreneurship, to really be more, how do you say, visible, and can do more. Besides, of course, the religious institution. But see, part of that is being Catholic. They're already caught into the Catholic mode, I would say. And unless they start developing another activity or unit that is strictly Filipino, and I think there is move towards that by some of the Catholics. They're getting stronger, whether the church will allow them, that's another thing. and coming out with some of their priests, although there have been some other scandals in that thing, and the for instance, some of their coming together as a Catholic, the Cursillos is another area that needs to be looked at. The gathering are sort of like a support group of the Filipinos. They call them the Cursillos in the Catholic Church, where they have gatherings, retreats, workshop. That could be part of the stronger structure within the community. The businesses is important. The Chamber of Commerce, the professional group are already strong. I mean, are strong in a sense that they're there and they could do a lot of things if they really focus on, say, promotion of scholarships, big money to schools, big even to the politicians. Mm-hmm. And they have the resources, they have the money. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the challenges, and then obviously dealing with some of the social human services that is beginning to show, or there, the seniors and the elderly. They don't have a really place to go that could be developed. The fakla is supposed to be, but with all the problems that is with it, because of leadership, it's not happening. So there has to be some other substitute, the youth, the gangs, the dropping out. We have a big dropout, high dropout among the Filipinos. In spite of that now, that's the opposite of the Philippine tradition of get your education and move up. Here now, the Americanization part of whatever is happening within here, a great deal of dropout. One of the biggest headaches of the UCLA student group and the Filipinos there is the high dropout. They're not graduating. So something needs to be, some activity needs to be performed or done to maintain, sustain, support them to, hey, stay with it.
So they're looking at that? They're conscious of this and looking at that?
And UCLA? Yeah, very conscious.
So are you involved with that?
A little bit, yeah. I'm more involved in the sense of sort of like providing support, advice to the students and through the school, through the classes that I teach at UCLA or Cerritos or Cal State. So that's where that's where I put some of my energy to encourage them, hey, you got to maintain your support system, your alumni support, and providing the syllabus, the curriculum. So I try to emphasize campus community connection so that there is togetherness. Students coming to the community, be aware, participate, get involved. The community youth. Yeah, we do that.
I know, as being a student on campus, mm-hmm. that the university never emphasizes being part of the community.
Mm-hmm. And so we try to continue and maintain that, and some of us are strong in supporting that. The graduation. Uncle Roy?
Yeah, Uncle Roy.
Yeah, I'm the Uncle Roy's around. I go over and you really have that many relatives? there you go, the extended family, right? So that's part of the emphasis that I do. And so not only providing support, but being around, mentorship, role model, and then the on graduation. They have a separate Filipino graduation ceremony at UCLA or in the other campuses, so we encourage that and support it. So that's part of that identity, ethnicity, and community campus connection. Mm-hmm. And the students are love it. They're really very interested. There's some who don't care, but most of the leadership and the key people, the Samahang, and they have their own group now. They have the student support group that try to work with them.
So you really very much are a role model.
That's what they call me.
Hungry for a role model.
Very hungry. They're very hungry. They're in search of their identity, their history, their culture, and what are we here for, kind of thing. Which is, I think, it's good. No, but if that keeps coming back, I think that would help a lot. I guess in the 80s, they all wanted to be yuppies. See, and so that's And a lot of them are, you know, you don't see them around, or they don't care. So that's the other part. So there were some that, you know, hey, you thought, hey, here it is, you know, the community is there. And because of the 80s, some of them are seven, Asia, I'm for myself now.
Yeah. So you're teaching a class right now.
Mm-hmm.
What is that called?
Filipino American Experience. And it's about history.
Where is that?
Right now, the one I'm teaching currently is Cerritos Community College, Wednesday nights. And the last one I just taught with the summer class. So now the Cerritos for the fall, and then winter back to UCLA. And then I don't
you
know.
Teach a class at UCLA?
Mm-hmm. Twice a year.
Is that through
summer?
Japan?
Summer extension, and then Asian American studies.
Do you get many students?
Too many. About 100 a class. And it's a combination of Filipinos, Chinese, Japanese, Koreans, some Anglos, few of them. And one or two blacks sometimes take that. But it's usually a very, very popular class. Partly, I guess, because I've been doing it several times. I'm sure a lot of the word gets around, hey, it's a fun class, it's okay. You can get a good grade if you do your homework, you know, and all these things. So it's a generous class. And so and we have a community tour.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Where would you take people?
I show them the early place where the Filipinos were in the main street, Japantown, the old Weller Street, to Bunker Hill. You sort of follow, and then when I talk about the waves of immigration, they sort of follow the shift of the people towards the current times. So they get to see downtown all the way to Chinatown, to the newer places. There was the City College, and then come back over here, and then they see all the different institutions that has some historical significance, from the Bunker Hill, from downtown, the taxi dance hall, to downtown, the churches, the groups, Bunker Hill, where the stores were, they're no longer there. We show them the pictures of the old times. Then the Filipino Christian Church, Fakla, history, and then you go to the different restaurant. Then you end up in a restaurant to have some Filipino food. And they like that. And then they meet people, they see some of the older folks, they want to interview them or all this. Then they come back. They see the institution, they see this place, they come back and volunteer or do some interview for their class. Seniors group. And so it's a whole day, and then it has an extra point.
Do you think in general Angelinos are aware of a Filipino-American community?
I don't think so. There may be a little piece of it. I think LA Times did a good job by doing some of the voices and the exposure, you know, and when they did a little bit about the Filipinos. And that's good. But they are doing it more because the community is asking for it, and then they see they see that there's a lot of it, visibility. And they know that there's a big population over there, and they're buying LA Times. Yeah. So there is more exposure by the media. And then I think they see the fact that all this Filipino newspaper coming out. So they said there's a market out there. Yeah.
What work are you involved in now here at the Refugee Service Center?
Basically the alcohol program, providing education, counseling, awareness, technical assistance, the development of alcohol-related services to enhance this. And that's Pacific Asian as well as Filipinos. Then we also do the statewide activities about again, training, technical assistance for agencies, and development of bilingual, bicultural staff to work in the alcohol drug field. And basically, that's what I do, and then provide some consultation to various institutions that may be looking for syllabus on the Filipinos or the Asian Americans. And then, of course, the teaching that I do in consultation for the schools.
Why is it called Refugee Service Center?
Oh, this one is basically developed by Supervisor Edelman in the 70s, right, as soon as the refugee from Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia came to America. And when we had the big influx, the county has to respond. We were working with Jim Miano, who is one of the aides there at that point in time, and he was working with Edelman. And he suggested the development of a refugee service center, one-stop place where refugees from Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos can come here for services, from welfare to mental health to alcohol to welfare, to other things, week program. And that's how it got started. And through Supervisor Edelman, they created this and became one of the first one in America to have something like this.
Was it then a model?
It was a model, yeah.
So you're
still
you're
is, so.
In this umbrella here, mm-hmm. in sort of the alcohol division?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And we're private, funded by the state or county, but within a county facilities that provides different programs, also house the elderly, to socialization for the elderly Vietnamese. And then we have the youth programs for some of the Cambodians. So it's, and it's got expanded, and there's a lot of refugee program here. And this is the only one here, really, in L.A. also, although there are other refugee programs. But it's county funded, and I'd say the brainchild of Supervisor Ed Edelman was very responsive to human services anyway.
What would you say some of the similarities and differences are from the experience of when you first came, well, actually your second time coming to the United States in the 1950s, when you came here to live, and immigrants arriving now from the Philippines and also other places?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the big difference is in my time, we don't really have the immigrant waves. There was more few immigrants coming in, so it's less intense. My purpose was educational, basically educational, and not so much an economic thing. Although at the end, it's economic education. While now you have so many waves. And there is a high and numerous number of immigrants coming in all at once. So that the community is saturated with various immigrants as well as refugee. And the refugees have a different status because they are refugees, they're exiles for political reason.
You can't go home.
Yeah, they can't go home. There's a different... they were forced into it. They didn't really want to come here, but here they are.
Like the Hmong.
Yeah, like the Hmong or the Cambodian or the Vietnamese. And so are the others that are now coming in from other parts of the world. So that makes it a lot different. Then you have the reaction of the community now of the immigrant aliens. And I think there is more... the reaction now, I'm talking about this decade, in regards to the number and the saturation of the big cities with new immigrants. And I think that is a really difficult one for the system, the city, whether it's the city, county, or state, or the government, to really handle. They're not prepared, or businesses. So it's difficult. Then you have high unemployment, plus we're in a depression or recession, whosoever definition, the economic slump. And then you have some reactionaries who are coming down. Is going to start blaming the immigrant. So that's the other, that's the difference. The number and the diversity of culture, language, the education, whatever background. Filipino immigrants are basically the quote educational elite of the Philippines coming here. Economic reason.
So
before
it's a different situation.
It's very different. facing a lot of problems. Then you have the undocumented coming in, who's hiding under, going into the economy, participating in a lot of things, but they are under cover. And so, those are some of the people that was playing the hide and seek game, and that's also causing a lot of turmoil within the community and exploitation. I know for sure a lot of Filipinos exploiting other Filipinos because of their own status as undocumented, and so it makes it difficult for some of them. And doesn't matter if they were very well educated, the doctors or lawyers or whatever their credentials from the Philippines, if they don't have the documents, they're going to be caught with the stress of trying to hide and seek. And for the newer ones, or those who are even those legal, you know, again, the issue of re-education, reorientation, they may face the unemployment and or lack of employment, and they're causing some problems with their own selves and their own status and their direction. And it's growing. I understand, you know, in LA County last year, we have about at least 25,000 Filipinos came to LA.
What would you say your greatest successes have been in your life?
I made it through the struggle. You know, so I would say I'm comfortable, family, and be able to at least do some impact with some creative things, new things in the community, advocacy, I think, and being able to develop some programs for the community in terms of specific services is the development of, say, SIPA, Search to Involve Filipino Americans. Youth program. We were there back in the 70s. Yeah, we were the few who said they're not going to make it. It's difficult. They say, yeah, but we have some second generation who put it together. It's a combination of those born, raised in the Philippines, and second generation here. And I think that was good. So in a sense, some of us at that point in time in the 70s started saying, hey, and let's respond to some of the community youth problems. So that's going. The other one I would say probably is the organizing participation with the coalition of Asian Americans and Pacific Islander groups, including the development of this. We're very supportive of this. We have the Asian Pacific Planning Council still going on, pretty active, strong force in the community. I was part of that development. Asian American Education Commission was very aware, though. We were there. Asian American Studies, UCLA, development of that from this ground zero to the current things they've got, you know, and then the continuation of the Filipino American class was part of that. Of course, I tried to take some pride in the continuation and role of the Filipino Christian Church, where I was part of it in the earlier times. Survived as a student through it, married through it, still there. My children goes there. We've tried to participate and still moving.
So many of the photos that we documented.
And some of the photos.
A lot of the photos were centered around that church.
Mm-hmm. And some of those photos were my photos.
Yeah.
Yeah, and some of the farms. So those are some of the, I would say, part of that. And been honored many, many times, you know, by the community, greater community, by the mayor, Supervisor Edelman, you know, that kind of thing. But goes with the territory, I guess, when you get visible. You know, so those are, I think, and still working closely with the kids. Mm-hmm.
What about disappointments?
Disappointments?
Yeah.
Probably my disappointment would be, not for myself, I try to be optimist. Oh yeah, I'm a member of the Optimist Club, Filipino-American, since 66. Their club is still going on.
It's called the Optimist Club?
Yeah, Filipino-American Optimist Club.
What do they do?
a friend of the youth. It's part of the, like a Kiwanis International or the Rotary. And the Japanese American were the first one club, so they created the closeness, friendship, part of the war and all those things. They became close to the, some of the Filipinos in the 60s. And so they formed the Filipino American Club. So we were part of that. I joined after that. I joined at the time of, you ever heard of a famous Roman Gabriel? Football player of the Rams?
No.
With Allen? Greatest?
I don't really know.
Okay, the 60s, 70s, one of the best football team in the country was the Rams. And the quarterback that came from North Carolina was German or Hungarian Filipino. Was Roman Gabriel. And so was one of our idols in the 60s. And he and I joined the Optimist Club at that point in time. So can you just imagine, it's 6'4 and 5'2 standing side by side being installed as Optimist. And we do youth programs, Respect for Law, a lot of things. That club has been very supportive of SIPA on some of the youth programs, the church. So there's a collaboration, combination work of community development, youth development, and
you
still doing
it. About disappointments, not for yourself.
Disappointed is probably seeing